Hello everyone and welcome to our KrausCast webinar series. My name is Amy Beecham and I'm the Marketing Director here at Kraus Financial. Today's topic is what happens when my Medicaid compliant annuity client passes away, the triggering events of an annuity, hosted by our founder and CEO, Dale Kraus. First, we have a few housekeeping items for you. If you have any questions during today's webinar, you can go ahead and type those in the questions section of the GoToWebinar toolbar. We will answer them at the end of the presentation. Next, a copy of today's slide deck can be found in the handout section of the GoToWebinar toolbar. And we also ask that you please complete the post-webinar survey that will pop up on your screens at the end of the presentation, as we truly do appreciate your feedback. And now let's get to the presentation. Dale, I will turn it over to you.
Thank you, Amy. Well, here we go. Another wonderful topic to talk about. My name is Dale Kraus. I'm the founder and CEO of Kraus Financial Services. And the topic today, as Amy mentioned, is what happens when a client passes away, the triggering events of a Medicaid compliant annuity. For those who know very little about us, you know, I started Kraus Financial Services more than 30 years ago, and I was a practicing attorney doing primarily estate planning at the time. And I first realized that with a Medicaid compliant annuity, I could help my clients who were in crisis and going into the nursing home. And so I was, you know, I developed one of the first commercial Medicaid compliant annuities back in the 90s. And then from the 90s to today, you know, we've seen a lot of changes, with the last major change regarding annuities coming with the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005. So here we are more than 30 years later. We've got 40 professionals on staff, and we're working on about 400 cases every month for attorneys who work with us. And I've always said that, you know, our practice, or my practice here at Kraus Financial Services, really grew because of the fact that working with all of you, if you're successful and your clients are happy, that brings us the success that we have. And it's because of this longstanding relationship, not only with you, but with the products and the insurance companies we work with, that we're today doing a wonderful job in this area of Medicaid crisis planning. So today I have three goals. First, I'm going to talk about the Medicaid compliant annuity and what it is, you know, who are its parties, and I'll define some of the requirements related to it. And then the second goal is to talk about the death claim process when we talk about a Medicaid compliant annuity. Now, remember, the death claim process is really, in a lot of the cases we work on, especially with the Deficit Reduction Act, forcing annuities to be much shorter, we don't see as many death claims as we used to, but it is important to understand how the death claim process works. When someone has a Medicaid compliant annuity, they predecease the term and there's remaining payments. And that's really what we're going to cover today. And then I'm going to show you a couple of the strategies on how the Medicaid compliant annuity works and the impact that the death claim process has on those plans. So what is a Medicaid compliant annuity? As I told you earlier, I've been using them since the 90s, and over the years they've changed. But a Medicaid compliant annuity is an insurance product. It's what we refer to in the insurance industry as a single premium immediate annuity. So when you're buying a product, a Medicaid compliant annuity, it's being purchased from an insurance company that offers the unique design. Now, most insurance companies have single premium immediate annuities, but in order to have a Medicaid compliant annuity, it has to have special features. Now, why does a Medicaid compliant annuity work? And how did I get it to begin working? Well, the problem that most clients have is when they're faced with trying to qualify for Medicaid. And those clients are ones where a loved one's in the nursing home, they are getting the private pay bill, it's $8,000 to $10,000 a month. The family does simple math and they say, boy, without some financial assistance, the life savings that took us forever to save is going to be gone in, you know, a couple of years or less. And so in wanting to get on Medicaid, they know that those excess assets, they have to deal with those. And the way they deal with them is by converting the excess cash assets into a Medicaid compliant annuity. Now, the Medicaid compliant annuity is designed so that it has no cash value. Unlike most annuities that our clients will have, like if they have tax-deferred annuities, variable annuities, They have cash value, but a Medicaid compliant annuity has no cash value. And that's what really provides the opportunity to qualify for Medicaid, because we're really taking a large sum of assets that they can have and be eligible, converting them into a future income stream, which has no liquidity, no cash value, which then gets them eligibility, because by spending down the excess assets gets them the eligibility. Now, our products are offered in 49 states plus the District of Columbia. We have terms as short as 2 months. Again, we only say that because there's very few cases where a two-month annuity makes sense. But we can go as short as two, and we can go as long as the life expectancy tables tell us. And the minimum investment is $5,000. So if you have a case involving a spend-down amount that's less than five, there's so many other ways to eliminate that smaller amount. And so the annuity really isn't available in that scenario. But for cases involving $5,000 or more, the Medicaid compliant annuity is the tool we typically use. So how does a Medicaid compliant annuity work? Again, you know, it's not a pre-planning tool. It's basically to be used when someone, when a family has a loved one in the nursing home, they've exhausted all of their private pay, you know, whether they have long-term care insurance or Medicare benefits, but they're destined to stay in the nursing home for the remainder of their life, and they're getting this private pay bill. At that point, they want to consider using a Medicaid compliant annuity. Well, most families, the first steps they'll take is they'll, you know, if it's a husband and wife, say the husband's in the nursing home, the wife's at home, you know, they're told they should pay down their bills. So if they have bills or outstanding obligations, they should also take some of this excess funds that cause them to be ineligible and improve or upgrade things. So if the house needs some repairs, it's a good time to do it. If the two cars are no longer viable, you know, they can get one new car. They can buy some prepaid funeral plans. They can pay off any estate planning work that you're doing for them. So that anything they do that enhances their own life is a good spend down. But for most families, you know, once they eliminate all of those items, then they'll still have some remaining funds. And at that point, they'll use a Medicaid compliant annuity. Now, in order to be a Medicaid compliant annuity, the immediate annuity has to have five main requirements. The first requirement is that it be irrevocable, meaning that once we set this contract up with the insurance company, nothing can be changed. So you can't change the parties to the contract. You can't change the premium that's invested. You can't change the monthly payout. And so you can't change anything on it. So once it's in force, it's no longer revocable in any way. So you got to make sure that when you set these contracts up, that you understand everything about your case so that you're not looking to make changes. Because once it's in place and it's past the, what's called the free look period, which is typically 20 to 30 days, depending on the insurance company, then it's locked in stone. No, nothing can be changed at that time. Now, the second requirement is non-assignable. So once the person who purchased the annuity, so if we have a husband and wife, the husband's in the nursing home, and the wife who's the healthy spouse uses the spend-down amount and buys a Medicaid-compliant annuity, she cannot assign the contract or any of the payments of the contract to a third party for value. So if this contract is irrevocable and non-assignable, it has no marketability on the secondary markets. Because we all know of companies that will buy like receivables, they'll buy lottery payments, they'll buy insurance policies. And if a company who's going to make the purchase has the ability to change the terms and get past the non-assignability provision, then the contract would have value on the secondary market. But a Medicaid compliant annuity, because it's irrevocable, non-assignable, no third party can take control of it. So it really has no value to them. So the only person that the contract has value to is the owner. Now, the third requirement is actually sound. Actually sound just means that the person who buys the annuity, so if the annuity is the community spouse and she's 75 and female, we would go to the life expectancy table and we can determine the longest possible term that she can purchase the annuity. Because in the old days, when the actually sound test first came out, and that was with transmittal 64, so I'm going back to November of 94. But when it first came out, it was you could buy a contract, but it couldn't be too long. And so the government wanted to make sure that it was actuarially sound, paid out within a reasonable time period. So the actuarially sound test is a test that says you can't go longer, but you always can go shorter. Now, the fourth requirement is equal payments. What this means is that every payment from the contract, once it's in payout, has to be identical in amount. So there's no inflationary increases. There's no balloon payments. Every payment from beginning to end is the same amount. And then the last requirement is the state has to be a designated beneficiary. So again, getting back to that simple case, the husband's in the nursing home, the wife's buying an annuity. The rules for a community spouse annuity is that the state has to be primary beneficiary to the extent of benefits paid to the husband. So if the wife dies and there's payments remaining in the contract, the state would have the right to recover from the balance of the payments to offset what it paid for the husband's care. So these are the five requirements. And if we have these requirements in the contract, then we would refer to it as a Medicaid-compliant annuity, meaning that it's not an asset, it's just a future income stream, and it's not subject to any type of divestment penalty. So it's a transfer for full value and allows someone who couldn't get on Medicaid because of excess assets, if those assets are then put into the contract and are paid out in future payments, they're now eligible. So the contract allows Medicaid eligibility. So when we talk about the MCA, who are the parties? Well, you have these five parties. So you have an owner, that's the person who purchases the contract. So in that simple case with the husband and wife, if the wife is buying the contract, she is the owner. The annuitant is the measuring life. The annuitant, when the annuitant passes away, then that triggers the beneficiary provisions. And so in most cases, with a community spouse being the owner, she would be the owner, annuitant, and payee. And the payee is the party who gets the monthly payments from the contract. And in that same scenario, the state would be primary beneficiary to the extent of any benefits paid for the husband's care. And then the contingent beneficiary, assuming there were something left over, is typically the couple's children. So those are your parties to the contract. And again, once we set up the annuity and it's past the free look period, then it's irrevocable as to these parties. So you can't alter or change them after the fact. So when is a Medicaid compliant annuity appropriate? Well, I told you earlier that it's not a pre-planning tool. So we don't ever use them when we're worried about someone going into the nursing home. We really use it as a last tool in our toolbox for when we have the situation, we know that the person's in the nursing home, they've got some longevity, so they're not on their deathbed. We expect to pay for some time, and the private pay cost is expensive, and someone then wants to go on Medicaid. It's at that point that we would find the Medicaid compliant annuity as the viable tool to get eligibility by spending down those excess assets through the purchase of a Medicaid compliant annuity. And so once the annuity is put in place, if all of the problem assets are eliminated, we then get Medicaid eligibility. So let's talk about the death claim process. Now remember, the death claim process only is important if, and again, I'll try to stay with that simple example. We got a husband in the nursing home. The wife wants to get him on Medicaid. She buys this annuity with the excess assets. It's structured so that it's irrevocable, non-assignable. It's actuarially sound, pays back within her life expectancy, and the state's primary beneficiary. Now, if she dies and there's payments left over, the state is the primary beneficiary. So at that point, the state then comes into the contract, and they now trigger, and they have the authority to then contact the insurance company or contact our firm, and they will get paid from what's left in the annuity. So the first thing we have to understand is we have to have a Medicaid-compliant annuity that's in play, and the person who owned it, who's the annuitant, passes away and payments remain. Now, I can tell you that since the DRA was put in place, most annuities go shorter than longer because the community spouse in a community spouse case is typically worried about living you know, pre-deceasing the contract. So they're going to want to go shorter than longer. And if they go less than their actual life expectancy, the contract will automatically end when the last payment goes out, meaning there's no residual benefits. So if a simple example would be if you got a husband and wife and the husband's in the nursing home and the wife needs to get him on Medicaid, she puts it into an annuity and she picks a 12-month term. And 12 months later, you know, the husband's still in the nursing home. She collected all the payments. On the 13th month, there's no contract left. The contract automatically ended after the last payment, meaning there's no death claim. So it's only in the event we have an annuity that's still in payout where the owner annuitant has passed away and there's payments left over that we worry about a death claim. So what are the options? So again, talking about the scenario, we'll assume we have the husband in the nursing home, the wife buys an MCA, she picks a 48-month term, she dies in 36 months, and there's 12 months remaining. At that point, if the husband was already gone, because typically, you know, when I think of these cases, try to keep it simple, if the husband goes in the nursing home and he's there for 16 months and dies, and the wife has a 48-month payout, she's gonna continue to get those payments. Well, the fact that he's gone 16 months later, what do we know? We know that there's still an obligation out there because the state paid for a good part of what his nursing home costs were. And if she dies before the last payment, the state, as the primary beneficiary, then jumps in and says, okay, because he's gone, they have an obligation to us, and we're the primary beneficiary. We want to get a lump sum payout so we can pay off the amount that we expended on his behalf. And so in that scenario, the state would request a lump sum payout to pay off what they paid for his benefits. Now, again, the contract will only have so many payments left. So if there were 12 payments remaining and the amount that was owed to the state was more than those payments, the state only gets what's left in the contract. That's it. So if there's only one payment left, they'll get one payment and there's nothing left in the contract for the contingent beneficiaries. So in typical cases involving a community spouse who the husband dies and the community spouse dies and there's payments left over, the state is going to collect from the balance of what's in the contract. And if there's anything left, it goes to the contingent beneficiaries. Now the other payout option is what where you continue the payments. So typically we see this when we have, let's say the husband's in the nursing home, the wife's at home, she's the healthy spouse, but he has an IRA account and you're in a state where IRAs are countable. And let's say his IRA account is $100,000. Well, because that money's never been taxed before, we're going to recommend that he have a full payout on his contract. So to get the spend down amount eliminated, which is the $100,000, he invested into an MCA. He's the owner, the annuitant, the payee, and his wife's the primary beneficiary. Because when the institutionalized spouse owns a contract, the community spouse can be primary and the state secondary. So because it's IRA funds in that scenario, when he dies, because again, he goes into the nursing home, he's got a $100,000 IRA, he can't be eligible until he gets down to $2,000 or less by buying an IRA MCA in his name and then stretching out over his full life expectancy. We'll just guess and say it's 75 months. We know that if he dies in 12 months, there's the remaining payments. Now, she would collect those and continue those. But what's unique about that situation is when he dies and after month 12, she gets payments 13 through 75. If she doesn't live the full term, she names another backup beneficiary. Because when we have that scenario, if he dies, she gets a new contract number because they're IRA funds. They've never been taxed. She collects the payments. If she's there to collect all the remaining payments, then she gets those. Now, we wouldn't recommend that she cash out that contract because if she does, the tax consequences of cashing out a $100,000 IRA all at once can be significant. So in that case, she would typically continue to receive the payments until the contract ends. And that's pretty typical. So again, in that scenario where we have IRA funds in the institutionalized person's name and we need to spend down to $2,000, he would buy an MCA IRA in his name, owner, annuitant, payee. His wife's the primary beneficiary. So when he passes on, she automatically gets the balance of those payments, and she opts to continue them until the contract ends. So the state is primary beneficiary. So let's get back to the first case. Let's assume that the wife purchases the annuity and she predeceases in the state's primary beneficiary. Well, what typically happens in those cases is the kids who are the secondary beneficiary will let us know that mom has died and dad typically is gone because, you know, in a normal scenario, dad goes in the nursing home, passes on after 16 months. Mom has a 48-month annuity. She dies in the 36th month, so there's 12 payments remaining. The kids will call us and say, no, dad's gone. Mom's now gone, and they want to know what's in it for them. Well, we have to figure out what's owed to the state before we can determine what they get. And so what we do is we would get the state to give us the amount that's owed to them because, again, they're primary beneficiary. And the state would have what's called a Medicaid reimbursement rate. We all know that states have two rates. They have a private pay rate and a Medicaid rate. And so when the husband's in the nursing home, he's paying a copay. His copay is his share of the cost. And so that's deducted from the Medicaid rates. So let's say the Medicaid monthly rate is $6,000. Husband pays $2,000. That's his Medicaid copay. So every month he was in the facility, $4,000 is owed to the state. Well, if he was alive 16 months, we would owe $4,000 times 16 months. That's the claim amount. And so we would know what the total is. And then we know how many payments are left in the contract. We then just do the math. And then we can tell the kids, well, here's what's left for you, if anything. Now, again, because these contracts are typically shorter than longer, we usually don't see too many of these claims, but this is how you do it when you run into one of those. So the death claim process, again, typically, you know, the kids will contact our office and say, dad was gone before mom. Mom now has passed and she had this MCA. And there's payments remaining. What do we do? We'll then get their permission to contact the insurance company. We'll notify the insurance company that mom has passed and that we need to know what's left in the contract. So then the insurance company will develop a letter and we'll send it out to the claimants and say, you know, if you take a lump sum, here's what's available. If you take continue the payments, here's what's left. And so all of that's put together in a letter. And then typically the kids will give us permission to contact the state to see what's owed. And at that point, everything will be figured out. So if the state elects to get paid out because dad is gone and mom's now deceased, you know, they're just going to settle, take what's left in the contract, and that's going to be done. Now, how long does the process take? Well, it takes 30 to 120 days, depending on the situation. Now, in a few cases, we have seen the scenario where the husband's still in the nursing home alive. Mom's now gone. The state is not going to settle that claim until dad's gone. So even though mom's annuity had payments remaining in it, the state's not going to settle until dad's gone. So if dad, you know, went in with Alzheimer's and he survived mom and mom's contract had payments remaining at her death, the state is going to wait until dad's death occurs to finalize their claim, even though more likely than not, they're going to get whatever's left in that contract. Because we know when mom dies, how many payments were left. So we know what that total looks like. The question is, what's owed to the state? But the state typically will put off that claim until dad passes. So what does someone need to begin that claim process? Well, you know, we just need the policy owner's name, the contract policy number, date of death. Typically, the kids will send us the obituary. They'll eventually get the original death certificate. And then we'll get the main contact for the family who's going to, you know, work with us on that. And then we'll get all their contact information. And that's how the process really gets started. So we'll contact the insurance company, let them know of the death. We'll contact the states, tell them to develop their claim, and then we'll figure it all out once we have all those numbers. So let's talk about the single person case. Now, again, in most of the single person cases, what we find is that when the family comes to us and say dad's in all alone, mom's gone, dad's going into the nursing home or he's already in, the question becomes, how long is he going to live? Because what we typically hear from the children is they really don't know. He's doing okay, or maybe he got even a little better than he was when he was living alone because now he's getting the care that he needs. But in most of those scenarios where we don't have a good handle on how long a person's going to live, they'll engage what we call the gifting MCA plan. And what this means is that we're going to give away half the assets and we're going to use the other half to privately pay during the penalty period. Because whenever someone gives away something of value, Medicaid penalizes that case with an ineligibility period. Now, in order to get through the ineligibility period, we've got to privately pay. And so in the gifting MCA plan, the goal is to give half the funds away that are a problem. Because remember, a person who's all alone in order to get Medicaid needs to get down to $2,000 or less, a prepaid funeral arrangement, and some personal property. So if they have an extra $100,000, they've got to get rid of it. And so we typically will utilize the gifting annuity plan to get Medicaid eligibility as soon as possible, but it won't be immediate because of the transfer penalty. Now, in that case, when we buy this annuity, if, say, dad's in the nursing home, he's all alone, he's going to be the owner annuitant and the payee of the annuity, because when he makes a gift, he's going to buy an annuity that's, you know, a viable product, because he's going to be penalized for the gift, but we don't want the annuity to cause any problems because we want it to be a transfer for full value. Now, the state will be the primary beneficiary of his annuity, and the children will be the contingent. So here's our case. Robert, age 82, he has dementia. A family can no longer take care of him at home. He can't remain on his own, so they move him into a nursing home, and they then look at the cost, and they meet with a financial advisor and an elder law attorney to come up with a good plan for their dad. Well, we know that Robert's income is $2,350 from Social Security. We know the divestment penalty divisor in Robert's state is $8,450. This is the amount that the state has. Every state has a divisor, which means that if there's gifts that are made in that state, for every $8,450, a person's ineligible for 1 month of care. Now, we know in Robert's case, he's got total countable assets of $157,000. So he's got $2,000 in a savings account. He's got another $157,000. He already has a prepaid funeral. He doesn't need any more personal property or things that make his stay in the nursing home more comfortable. So we need to eliminate the $157,000 in order to qualify him for Medicaid. And the cost of his care in this nursing home is $9,600. So the first thing we do is, you know, again, I said he had $2,000 in a savings account, but assuming he didn't have that savings account, first thing we do is we take the $157,000, reduce it by $2,000, and we know that for him to be eligible, the children have to spend down $155,000. So in order to determine, how do we do the gift in the MCA? How long is the plan? To determine the length of the plan, we calculate what's called the burn rate. You know, how fast are we going to use up the money if we make a gift and we privately pay? And so we go through this formula. The cost of care we know is $9,600. We know that Robert's got $2,350 of Social Security income. We know that he's short $7,250 a month to privately pay. So if we add $7,250, take it out of his account, of his $155,000, and we take $8,450 and give it away, we know that he's going to use up his funds at about $15,700 per month. So if we then divide the burn rate into the spend-down amount, we know that his plan is going to be about 9.87 months. Now, we can't buy an annuity for 9.87 months. We can only buy a whole number. So in this case, because we're almost to 10, we round up to 10 months. And so it's going to be what we would refer to as a 10-month plan. So we take 10 months times the divisor, $8,450, And we know that Robert can gift away $84,500 of the $155,000 that's a problem. So now he could do it by way of an irrevocable trust, or he could make direct gifts. So if he's got two kids, he could say to them, I'm going to give you an immediate gift of $42,250 each. Now, I would recommend the gift tax return be done because you want to show that it's really a gift. It's not a transfer. You know, you don't want the kids to say, well, I'm just holding dad's money. It's an actual gift. Or you could do the irrevocable trust. And again, you could do the gift tax return for that. But that all solidifies the fact that it's truly a gift. And they're not holding it in like a constructive trust for dad, but it's an actual gift. Now, by giving that $84,500 away, we know that Robert's going to be ineligible for Medicaid for 10 months. So if he does that, we got $155,000, we reduce it by $84,500, and then we got $70,000 to put into the MCA. Now, again, Robert's going to own this MCA. He's going to be the owner, annuitant, the payee. The state's going to be primary beneficiary, and Robert's children are going to be contingent. This annuity is going to pay $7,055 a month for a total payout of $70,550. So is it a Medicaid-compliant annuity? Yes, it's irrevocable, non-assignable. It's actuarially sound. It pays out within his life expectancy, has equal payments, and it properly names the state as Medicaid beneficiary. And so this is an MCA. So this isn't an asset. It's a future income stream, and it's not subject to any type of penalty. So it's a transfer for full value. Now, you've got a timing is critical in these cases. So Robert makes the gifts. And again, if he can't do it himself because he doesn't have the cognitive abilities to make gifts, then we better find that there's a power of attorney with a gifting function in it, because otherwise he's not going to be able to make that gift. So we'll assume in this case Robert's still competent to make the gift. Robert makes the gift. He buys the MCA. He can't do one this month, one next month. He has to do them both together, and then he has to apply, because in order to get the penalty clock running, the 10-month penalty clock, we've got to show that he's made an application for Medicaid and he's otherwise eligible. But for, you know, the gift, which will then create the penalty, which will then start the penalty clock. So in this case, we know that if Robert's income is $2,350 and his MCA income is $7,055 and he's got total income of $9,405, he's short $195. But remember, we left him with $2,000. So he'll have the necessary shortfall in his savings account to cover that full $9,600. So now, if Robert passes away before the annuity ends, so in that case, we know that Robert's ineligible for 10 months. On the 11th month, Robert goes on Medicaid benefits because the annuity's ended. His copay to the facility is going to be that $2,350. And let's assume he gets to keep $50 for his personal needs allowance. He would pay $2,300 a month starting in month 11. So the plan is really a good plan if Robert's expected to live a long time, because the real windfall in this gifting annuity plan starts in month 11 when he's only paying $2,300 for a stay that's $9,600. But let's assume we didn't have a good handle on Robert's life expectancy, and he doesn't make it the 10 months. He dies early, you know, he dies in month 6. Well, the first thing I know, had I known about that as the planner, I would have said, if you have something that obviously shows that his death is imminent and he's going to die in 6 months versus 10 or longer, then I would have went with a standalone annuity. I would have said, let's get Robert full Medicaid eligibility immediately, because his life expectancy is only 6 months, and we would have bought a standalone annuity for the $155,000. Robert would have had $2,000 in savings account, put $155,000 in the annuity. We would have structured it over his full life expectancy, and then when his death occurred, we would reimburse the state at the Medicaid rate, And so the advantage of the standalone annuity versus this MCA gifting plan is the standalone annuity, you'd get the Medicaid rate right away. And so in many states, it's a $2,000 to $3,000 savings. But in this case, if we went the 10 months, because again, we didn't have a good handle on longevity, and he died in month six, because Robert had never been on Medicaid benefits, we wouldn't owe anything. So even though the state's primary beneficiary, the state would have no claim. Now, did we get a real benefit from doing the plan? No. If it's a 10-month plan and he agrees to pay for 10 months, no one is paying anything for his care because he's agreed to privately pay for 10. If he dies in month six, you know, the state's not owing anything, then the children as contingent beneficiary get what's left in the annuity. So again, we don't see that too often because, again, I think most families don't have a very good handle on longevity. And we'd have to know with certainty that he was going to die less than 10 to make sure it works. Because if we do the standalone annuity and he doesn't die in 6 months, and let's say he lives 12 months, we could end up losing more of the value by going longer than anticipated because we don't have the certainty of the date of death. But the date of death, as we know in life, hindsight is always 20/20. And if he died in month six, yes, the standalone plan in this case would have looked much better than doing the gifting annuity plan, because we would have reaped the benefit of the monthly Medicaid rate, which is $2,000 to $3,000 less than the private pay rate. But again, so if Robert passes away in this scenario, because he was never on Medicaid benefits, the state as primary beneficiary would say, we have no claim. The children then fill out the claim paperwork as contingent beneficiaries, and the balance would go to them. So they'd end up with whatever's left in the annuity, plus the initial gift they got from their dad. So now let's talk about the traditional community spouse case. So in the traditional community spouse case, we got to say the husband's in the nursing home, the wife's at home, and they have non-IRA assets. They have a savings account. It's got a lot of money in it, well over the amount that they're allowed to have. And so in order to get eligibility immediately, the community spouse has to invest the excess assets into an annuity for her benefit, and then the husband would be eligible for Medicaid when they show that all the excess assets are gone. So if the community spouse owns the annuity, because again, we're not talking about IRA funds, she would be the owner annuitant, the payee, the state would be primary beneficiary, and again, the children would be contingent beneficiary or a trust, whatever they have for an estate plan. So in this case, we've got John, age 81. He has dementia, recently entered a nursing home. His wife, Linda, is 79. She's concerned about the high cost and realizes that with simple math, if they continue to pay privately, their life savings will be consumed rather quickly, and she's worried. So she turns to a financial advisor and an elder law attorney to help come up with a plan. Now, this is what most families do, you know, because I think families don't always understand what happens when someone goes to a nursing home from an economic standpoint. If they have long-term care insurance, that's a different story. They'll work with that long-term care company to figure out how much is going to be paid from the plan and all of that. But for families where someone goes into a nursing home, a lot of times they go in under Medicare. Medicare can pay for skilled care in up to 100 bed days, but after, you know, 20, 30 days in the average case, you know, Medicare's done paying. And at that point, you're going from skilled care to custodial care, being the person's only in the nursing home for basic functions in life. It's not a medical necessity. It's just help with the basic functions. Because it's custodial care at that point, people have to privately pay or go on Medicaid. So in this case, John's income is $2,800. Linda's income is $2,500. They have total countable assets. So in other words, all of their assets are $395,000. John's cost of care is $9,000. So again, I think most families will say, you know, we've got these assets, divide $9,000 into it. How long are they going to last? And then Linda's worry is because she was younger and her health might be pretty good, you know, I'm worried that if I use up all of these funds, you know, paying for John's care privately, you know, how's she going to get by on what's left? And so first thing we do in these cases, we calculate the spend-on amount. So Linda gets to keep the family home, the car, the furniture, personal property, and $157,920 as her community spouse resource allowance. So again, the state's not worried about the value of the house, the car, the furniture, personal property. You can have one house, one car, traditional furniture, prepaid funeral plans, and then she gets to keep $157,920 of the cash assets. So she'll pick what account she wants, and then the rest are the problem assets. So in this case, we don't have any IRAs. It's just after-tax cash, so it's sitting in a savings account. And so John's allowed $2,000. So in this case, even though Linda gets $157,920, we don't want her on the edge of eligibility, so we suggest to her keep 155, and then John keeps two. So let's spend down $238,000. So again, if Linda wanted to, she could fix up the house, she could buy a new car, she could buy prepaid funeral plans, all of those items. And if that eliminated the spend down amount, John could go right on benefits. But in this case, Linda doesn't need a new car, doesn't need any home improvements. They really don't have any bills. And so she decides, let's go with the Medicaid compliant annuity as our spend down plan. So how do we determine the term of the plan? Well, in this case, we know Linda's 79. Her life expectancy is 119 months, according to the table. And so we could go as long as 119 months if we want to. But remember, what's Linda worried about? Linda's worried that if she doesn't live 119 months and she predeceases, let's say she only lives 5 years. So she's then worried that the remaining payments would go to the state to offset what it paid for her husband's care. And so she's going to go shorter than longer. But we typically use a shorter term when the community spouse or institutionalized spouse has a shorter life expectancy, because the goal is to get the money back before their death. And then we use a longer term when, you know, the community spouse says, look, I really need more reliable income. I know that when my husband dies, I'm going to pick the larger of the two Social Security checks, but I don't want my income to fall drastically, but I want it as long as possible. So in some cases, we'll go longer. We also use longer terms when we're dealing with IRA funds, and that's because of the taxation issues. Anytime you liquidate an IRA account all in 1 year, you're going to have a high tax obligation. And so with IRAs, we try to stretch it out a little longer. Now, you can never mix IRA funds and after-tax funds in the same product. You have to have separate products for qualified and non-qualified funds. So in this case, Linda says, well, let's go with a 48-month annuity. I'm going to take $238,000, buy a 48-month annuity. I'm going to get $49.80 a month for a total payout of $239,040. So the payout's not what we're looking at. It's just making sure we have a Medicaid-compliant annuity. Linda's the owner, annuitant, payee, state's primary beneficiary, and the children are contingent. So Linda, in this case, feels pretty good. The fact she's 79, her health is good. She thinks she'll survive the 48 months. She realizes that her husband isn't doing that well. He'll probably be gone. You know, the doctors have said 2 years or less. So even though he'll be gone, she'll still have this payout. 48 months is the term that's most comfortable for her. So now because she purchased the MCA, we know that her monthly income goes from $2,500 to $7,480 because of the income. Because her income is over the monthly maintenance needs allowance in her state, she doesn't get any of John's. All of John's income, less $50 for his personal needs, goes to the facility as his Medicaid copay. So he's paying $2,750 for a nursing home stay that's substantially more. So here's the pitch. You know, you meet with these clients, if you know what John's income is and you say, well, you know, because we know her income is going to go well over the MMNA, we say, if you're paying $9,000 a month, how would you like to pay $2,750? Most families will understand that concept and say, let's do it. How soon can we do it? It doesn't seem possible that this is allowed, but this is the pitch right here. So when you're meeting with clients, you really tell them, you know, you're paying this much privately. How would you like to pay $2,750? Most families understand that presentation. Now, if John passes away before the annuity ends, what happens? Well, John's not the owner annuitant. Linda is. So nothing happens. If John passes away, Linda continues to receive the payments until the 48 months are over with. So nothing happens because of John's death. John's Medicaid benefits end. We know that he paid $2,700 a month for his care. We know the state picked up the balance. We know there's an outstanding obligation to the state because we can figure out about what it is. But as long as Linda continues to collect all of her payments, you know, there may be no payback to the state. Now, if Linda passes away before it ends, so she dies before the 48th month, if John's still living, the state isn't going to do anything because they're going to hold the claim open. No one else is going to get any of the payments. If Linda dies and there's 48 payments scheduled, the month she dies, let's say she dies in month 30, the insurance company is going to be notified of her death. They're going to stop all payments. They're going to wait for the state to settle the claim as the primary beneficiary. So if John's still alive on the 30th month, because for whatever reason he's still alive in the nursing home on Medicaid, the state's going to say, we're not going to deal with the claim until John's gone. At that point, we'll know what the final amount is. We'll then settle. Now, if John's not living, then the state's going to say, oh, I see here that this case, John died a year ago. So let's, you know, the typical plan is John's in the nursing home. He lives 16 months, dies. She's got a 48-month plan. She dies, you know, in month 40. There's 8 months left. We know that at that point, we can calculate what's owed for John's care, and then there's 8 payments left. The state would then elect to take those payments. Now, again, if there's something left over, if the state's amount was very small and there were still funds left over, then the contingent beneficiaries would get what's left. But with those case facts, more likely than not, the state's going to get whatever's left. And if the state doesn't get all of what they want, you know, the case is closed because the annuity is now done with. So let's talk about the name on the check rule. The name on the check rule really is a strategy that's used when, let's say in that last scenario, John had an IRA account. And we know that, you know, if John owns the IRA, you can't just put it in the spouse's name. We want to deal with it. So in that case, if John had an IRA, we know he's got to get down $2,000. Well, the only way we can get him down is by buying him an IRA MCA. Now, he could liquidate the account and give the after-tax dollars to his wife, but that's got a huge tax hit. So if the account is sizable, that could have some significant tax costs, which really would not benefit the two of them. So in this case, we would recommend that we go ahead and have him buy an MCA, stretch it out over his full life expectancy, and then we would say that he's the owner annuitant, and then we would name her as the payee. So in this case, Linda would be the payee, and then the contingent beneficiary would be the state Medicaid office. So again, what are we doing? What the name on the check rule stands for is that the Medicaid office says whoever's name is on the check, it's their income. So we know that we have to spend down his IRA because he can't get eligibility until he's down $2,000 or less. So we buy the annuity in the institutionalized person's name. He's the owner annuitant, and we list her as the payee because the checks she'll get, we ask for hard checks. Because the checks come in her name, it'll be considered her income. So even though he owns the annuity and is properly annuitized because she is the payee, and we dictate that to the insurance company, it becomes her income. And so this is a unique way to get more income to the community spouse by using the name on the check strategy. Now, again, most of the time we find that the community spouse has more income over the MMNA, and by using the name on the check, we can get her even more income, which is a nice way to do it. But the thing that you got to understand with the name on the check rule is if he passes away, okay, because she's the payee, at his death, she then is the primary beneficiary. Because remember what I said earlier, when the institutionalized spouse owns the IRA, the primary beneficiary always is the community spouse, then the state. So Now, in that previous example, we had John and Linda. We'll assume that $238,000 instead of after-tax dollars was an IRA in John's name. So John had an IRA of $238,000 that we need to spend down. So we're going to buy the annuity over John's full life expectancy because we don't want to accelerate income taxation. So John's going to get $2,550. But because we put Linda as the payee, she's going to get the check in her name. So the check each month is going to come in Linda's name, and it's going to be deemed her income under the Medicaid rules. So the annuity's properly structured. It's MCA. You know, it's a Medicaid-compliant annuity. John's the owner annuitant. Linda's the payee. Linda's also the primary beneficiary. So if John dies and Linda's still alive, she continues to get the payments as the primary. And then the state is secondary. So how did that work out? Well, because Linda's getting his check, her income is $5,050 a month. So again, she's got more than the MIMNA allowance, meaning she gets to keep anything that comes in her name. John's income is the $2,800 less the $50. So again, he pays $2,750 per month for his Medicaid copay. So we've got eligibility, and so the name on the check rule is typically used when we have a husband and wife, the husband's in the nursing home, the husband has an IRA, we need to eliminate it in order to get Medicaid eligibility, so we use the name on the check rule to get the income while he's alive over to her as the payee. At his death, she still continues to get the checks as the primary beneficiary. And so that's how it works. And so this is a great opportunity for those clients who have IRAs in the institutionalized person's name that need to be spent down in order to get eligibility. So if John passes away before the annuity ends, and we'll assume that Linda predeceased, okay? Well, if Linda predeceased him and he's still alive and he then dies, I know that when Linda dies, she's no longer with us, so she's not the payee. John would become the new payee. So if Linda dies, because the triggering point is who's the primary beneficiary, but if John's the owner annuitant and Linda is the payee, if Linda dies, John is the new payee. So automatically, that would happen just because of the fact that he's the owner annuitant. And if the payee dies, in this case his wife, he becomes the payee. So it just continues on like before. And the state now would still have the petition, would have the position of contingent beneficiary because Linda's gone. She would have no ability to collect from that annuity. So again, it sounds complicated, but it's really not. We don't see this case very often. I mean, it's typically unlikely that you're going to see this scenario. So this would be a 1% case where the healthy spouse predeceases John, and then she was the payee because John automatically becomes the payee because of how the contract reads. Now, if John passes away before the annuity ends, and we know that Linda predeceased him, the state then recovers. So I told you that Linda was the primary beneficiary, and the state was secondary. Because Linda's no longer with us, she has no right to claim. So the state Medicaid office would collect from the balance. But the more typical situation that we see is this one. If John passes away before the annuity ends and Linda's still living, she switches from payee to primary beneficiary. As the primary beneficiary, because these are IRA payments, she would continue to collect the balance of the payments. And as I told you earlier in the presentation, because she's collecting these IRA funds, she has the right, because they give it a new contract number at his death. The contract gets a new contract number, and Linda has the right to name a successor beneficiary at that point. So whatever payments were left from the 90-some that he had, Linda continues to collect them, but there's a backup beneficiary provision that she fills out at the time of his death, so that someone else gets it. So in this case, the state would never recover against the contract. Now, what really happens? Most of the time, John would pass away, Linda would collect the bulk of the payments as payee, and she'd get the balance of them as the primary beneficiary. And that's typically how that scenario plays out. And with that, it's time for a few questions.
All right. Thank you, Dale. We do have a lot of questions. We were not going to have time to get through them all today, so I just want to let everyone know if we don't get to your question, we will follow up with you later this week. But let's get through a couple now here. First question for you, Dale, is it possible to cancel an MCA contract after it's been purchased?
No. Basically, a contract, when a client purchases one, there's a free look period. That means that they have a chance. The insurance commissioners in every state require that there be a free look period. So it's to prevent any type of cases where someone gets pressured to buy something that they're not really interested in. They just buy it because they feel they don't have a choice. So the free look period is 20 to 30 days. So if the contract's issued, typically within the contract provision, there's a 30 day free look period where if the client changes their mind, they can get the funds back. But that's the only way that you can cancel a contract. If you don't do it within the free look period, it's not possible to ever do it later. So it's permanent once it's get past the free look. Is there another question?
Yes, let's do one more here. If I'm concerned about my client passing away before the annuity term ends, should I use a shorter term?
Yes, that's the million-dollar question. You know, I think you know, the community spouses, we always suggest that, you know, I told you earlier in the presentation that we have a two-month term. Now, I'm not going to tell every community spouse case to do a two-month term. So if someone invests $250,000 in an MCA contract, I would hate to see a two-month term because I think, you know, cases start to look abusive. And we all know that, you know, there's Medicaid reform coming. This Trump and his administration is talking about reforming Medicaid. So the last thing we want to do is create terms that are so short. So we typically recommend that you go as short as you need to feel comfortable, but try not to go too short. Because again, I think some of these cases might get a second look if they're too short, or if you keep presenting cases to your same caseworker and everyone's 2 to 3 months or 5 months, you know, and the monthly payments are getting excessive, it's hard to really get away from that taint. So again, always try to go as long as possible, but try to keep it within that person's expected life expectancy. So I'm not saying you got to go, 48 months, 60 months, but try to go longer than shorter, but keep it within their anticipated life expectancy.
All right. Thank you, Dale. A recording of this webinar will be available shortly through your attorney access account. If you don't already have an account, you can head on over to krausfinancial.com/join to get started. Signing up is quick and easy and gives you access to all of our latest educational content and long-term care planning resources. I want to thank you again, Dale, for your great presentation today, and thank you to everyone for joining us and for completing that post-webinar survey. I hope everyone has a great afternoon.